Hello everyone, John Sands speaking. Welcome to the Chester and Flint Talking Newspaper edition for Friday, February 27th. I hope all listeners are healthy and in good spirits. The weather hasn't been too bad, in spite of pessimistic weather forecasts. The gardens are springing into life. My lawn is looking rather healthy. And several flowers, including my miniature daffodils, are blooming, though the tulips have yet to make an appearance. Thank goodness the snow we had didn't last long. I hate it when the road surface is problematic. When I go to the shops in my little car, I worry when the roads are pitted and holed, and feel that the council should be doing something about it. That feeling was doubtless shared by a gentleman from Horsham in the south of England, who had a brilliant way of protesting. He filled in the road potholes with earth and planted lots of little flowers. They're not exhibition standard, but drivers should see them and hopefully avoid them. I have now been informed that the Borough Council were jolted into action and have now repaired the roads. Congratulations to the road gardener. He must be delighted. I wonder if anyone else will copy his example. It would certainly be an added interest. The days are certainly getting longer, so electricity bills should be diminishing. I've had to alter my lighting up times to save money already. Oh, one other thing I managed to remember. Renewing the green gardening bin permit. My bin will start filling up before long, and I'm rather too old to be shoving it about. I found the bin men very helpful when they're collecting. Thanks be to them. Well, whatever is going on, and there's plenty of that in national and international terms, life in the Chester area continues. Sunrise in Chester on Sunday, March the 1st, is 6:58 a.m. and sunset 5:49 p.m. And now over to the readers.
Hello everyone, Margaret Bellis here. A man has been found guilty of murdering his girlfriend at his home in Chester. Tony Devonport, 57, was convicted at Chester Crown Court today, Wednesday the 25th of February, following a 16-day trial. Stephanie Blundell was found dead at Devonport's house on Canal Street on Sunday the 20th of July, 2025. Her father contacted Cheshire Police at around 12:20 p.m. that day after discovering his daughter's body at the address. Officers and paramedics arrived within minutes and found Stephanie dead inside the property. She had visible injuries to her face, neck and body. Devonport was arrested and taken into custody. He denied being responsible for Stephanie's death during questioning. A post-mortem confirmed that her injuries were the result of a sustained and violent assault. Devonport was charged with murder and an additional count of manslaughter. A jury has now found him guilty of murder. He is due to be sentenced at Chester Crown Court on Friday, the 27th of February. Detective Inspector Andrea Price of Cheshire Constabulary's Major Investigation Team said, "Though I am pleased with today's outcome, there are sadly no winners in this case." Stephanie's family described her as a fun-loving, caring, beautiful girl, and my thoughts are with them today as they continue to come to terms with such a loss. Devonport was a coward. He has shown no remorse for his actions, and throughout the investigation, he has refused to admit what he did. Thankfully, the case presented in court against him was overwhelming, and the jury was left with no option but to find him guilty of murder. D.I. Price added, "Many victims of domestic abuse suffer in silence, isolated from those closest to them. If one thing can come from Stephanie's tragic death, it's encouraging other victims of domestic abuse to come forward and contact us. If you or someone you know is a victim of domestic abuse, report it by calling 101, that's 101, or visiting the Cheshire Police website. But in an emergency, always call 999.
Hello everyone, Esther Newt here. Chester celebrated the Lunar New Year in the house on Saturday, 21st of February, with performances of traditional music, lions and dragon dancing, non-combustible firecrackers and cultural characters. The God of Prosperity, the Emperor of Heaven and the Happy Buddha were in Chester City Centre in an event delivered by the Wali Chinese Association, supported by Bank of America, Cheshire West and Cheshire Council, and six other local organisations. Mia Tan, chairman and founder of Wali Chinese Association, said, "Lunar New Year is a time to celebrate culture, community and connection. This festival reflects the dedication of volunteers who have worked tirelessly since 2009 to deliver language classes and cultural programs that break down barriers and foster inclusion. We are proud to work with Bank of America, Cheshire West and Cheshire Council and other sponsors to bring this celebration to life." The event began at 11 a.m. in Eastgate Street, continuing along Northgate Street to Chester Town Hall. Lions were woken by representatives of Bank of America and Cheshire West and Cheshire Council. The Hung Ga Kung Fu Academy, led by Steve Omelas, showcased the colourful lions and dragon dance, followed by additional performances inside the Town Hall Assembly Room at midday. Calligraphy sessions and interactive activities were hosted by tutors from Wali Saturday Mandarin School from the University of Chester and volunteers inside the town hall with special guest Tai Chi Panda. Councillor Louise Gittin, leader of Cheshire West and Chester Council, said, "I would like to wish everyone a very joyful Year of the Horse. This was a celebration not to be missed." Lunar New Year, also known as Chinese New Year, is the most important celebration in the Chinese zodiac calendar and follows a 12-year cycle. Chinese legend states that the Emperor of Heaven asked all the animals to meet him on New Year's Day and named a year after each of the 12 animals that came to him.
Hello, Helen Holyoake greeting. A Kelsall man whose momentary blip of concentration caused a motorcyclist life-changing injuries will serve a community order. Stephen Wood, 62, and of Church Street, Kelsall, Chester, appeared at Chester Magistrates Court on Tuesday, February 24th. Wood pleaded guilty to causing serious injury through careless driving in relation to an incident in Barrow Lane on Thursday, September the 4th, 2025. Nigel Jones, prosecuting, told the court that the victim, Darren Lawrence, was riding his motorbike from Tarvin Road onto Barrow Lane towards Barrow. At the same time, Wood had slowed down and intended to turn right into a driveway. Wood had not seen the motorcyclist as he turned towards him in his car, and Mr. Lawrence was catapulted over the bonnet of the vehicle before hitting the road on the other side. He was taken via air ambulance to Aintree Hospital. Among several injuries, Mr. Lawrence suffered a deep laceration to the inside of his left leg. His pelvis was broken on the front and the back. He also suffered a fractured spine. A pre-sentence report was prepared to give magistrates further information on the defendant. The court heard that Wood had a momentary blip or lapse in concentration, in which he forgot to conduct a final check before turning. Wood was said to be inconsolable when he realised he'd hit someone, and the incident had exacerbated pre-existing mental health issues for which he was receiving therapy. Stephen Alice, defending, said that the incident had had a profound effect on the defendant, who had needed to contact the NHS crisis team and had shown remorse throughout, something noted by probation. Mr. Alice said that there had been no other aggravating factors and that he admitted his guilt at the earliest opportunity. Magistrates elected to hand Wood a 12-month community order during which he will complete 150 hours of unpaid work. He will also pay costs of £85 and a mandatory surcharge of £114. He was disqualified from driving for 12 months.
Hello, I'm Patrick Blunden. A carer was banned from the roads for drug driving. Lee Burris of Hill Street, Winsford, pleaded guilty to drug driving in Chester Magistrates Court on Tuesday, as well as possession of cannabis. Nigel Jones, prosecuting, told the court that on November the 5th last year, a police officer in Delamere Street noticed a Ford Transit van parked before moving off without indicating and settling over the road. Mr. Jones added, the officer felt it was because the driver had seen the police. And when the officer spoke to Burris, the 50-year-old admitted smoking cannabis an hour before being stopped. A small amount of cannabis was found on him, and he gave a drug swipe reading, which was above the legal limit. Stevie Bate, defending as duty solicitor, explained that her client had been using cannabis at the time to alleviate severe back pain. She added he has since spoken to his GP about medicinal cannabis and is hoping to go down that route. He accepts there was a lot of stress in his life, and there still is, as he is a carer for two people. All I can ask is that you keep his disqualification to the minimum and impose a financial penalty. Chairman of the bench, Andrew Merrill, fined the defendant £461 and ordered £85 in costs, and a surcharge of £184, making £730 overall. He was also given a 12-month ban from the road, but there was no separate penalty for possession of cannabis.
Hello, Caris Biddle here. Esther McVeigh, Conservative MP for Tatton, has called out Cheshire's Police and Crime Commissioner, Dan Price, for what she calls complete profligacy over three public consultations on policing the county, known as citizens' assemblies. Freedom of information requests made by Ms. McVeigh revealed the citizens' assemblies held in Crewe and Nantwich at the end of 2024 and in Runcorn and Widnes in July 2025 cost council taxpayers £200,565. The money was paid to London-based consultancy firm Think Insights and Strategy, which claims to combine pioneering research skills with outstanding thinking to help clients make better decisions. According to the PCC, six more assemblies are planned in the near future, which will include residents in Northwich, Winsford and Knutsford. Mr. Price has defended the assemblies, stating the cost of all nine will represent just 0.08% of the force's £1.1 billion budget while he is in office. Ms. McVeigh's claims came just days after Mr. Price was granted special permission from the government to increase the size of Cheshire Police's council tax precept above the agreed maximum. The application was made to secure the jobs of 87 of the force's police and community support officers who were facing redundancy due to a funding black hole. As the government only agreed to a smaller increase than Mr. Price asked for, 30 PCSOs are still set to lose their jobs from April. Ms. McVeigh said, "It beggars belief how anyone can have the audacity to ask residents to pay more when money is being wasted on exercises run by expensive consultancy firms. What my constituents want is for money to be spent on policing and keeping our streets safe." Responding to Ms. McVeigh's comments, Mr. Price said, "More than 86,000 people in Cheshire elected me on a promise to deliver on community-led policing. In Cheshire, the policing budget for my term is expected to be approximately £1.1 billion. So, of course, it's a good idea to ask the public how they would like some of that money spent in their local area. I'm doing precisely that and listening to what the public is saying." Esther's comments are misleading. Costs to hold the assemblies over several weeks per area include venue hire, independent facilitation, refreshments, and careful recruitment of a cross-section in residence, including those with huge trust in policing and those with none.
Hello, Pam Skinner here. A Chester man who admitted drug driving and driving without insurance was told there was a cell with your name on it if he did not pay outstanding court fines. John Horton, 32, and of Gongar Lane, Ashton Hayes, attended Chester Magistrates Court on Tuesday, February the 24th. Horton pleaded guilty to driving while over the limit for a controlled drug, cocaine, and driving without third-party insurance. Nigel Jones, prosecuting, told the court that on Monday, November 17, 2025, police officer Darlington was driving towards Ellesmere Port when an ANPR, automatic number plate recognition software, picked up a Peugeot 208. The officer pulled the car over, finding Horton as the sole occupant. A drug wipe conducted at the roadside tested positive for cocaine. Checks also showed that Horton was not insured to drive the vehicle. A blood test taken in custody showed Horton had a reading of more than 800 micrograms of the drug per litre of blood. The legal limit is 50 micrograms. Mr. Jones said Horton had four convictions from six previous offences, including an excess alcohol charge from 2018. Horton was fined £120 and will pay costs of £85 and a mandatory surcharge of £48. He was also disqualified for 36 months and his licence was endorsed. During a discussion about how he would pay his fines, Chair of the Magistrates, Geoffrey Langham, noted his four outstanding fines accounts, the latest of which last received a payment in 2022. The defendant had said that he had been struggling money-wise for the last few months, and the magistrates asked why it had been more than a few months since he last made a contribution to his fines. The defendant said he didn't know that he had outstanding debts, and Mr. Langham told him that if he did not make regular payments, there was a cell with your name on it.
Hello from Fiona Farger. River Dee Rescue in Chester. There was a major emergency services presence in the city centre on Thursday morning. Two fire engines from Chester and two fire engines from Ellesmere Port and Warrington, the aerial ladder platform from Chester and the rescue boat from Powie Lane attended the scene in Hanbridge at about 9:20 a.m. on Thursday, February the 19th. Police also closed off a nearby road while firefighters rescued two people struggling in a dinghy on the River Dee. A spokesperson for Cheshire Fire and Rescue Service said, "Crews were called to reports of two people in a dinghy struggling against the current on the River Dee in Chester. Firefighters established downstream safety measures, preparing throw lines in case either casualty entered the water. Swift water rescue technicians in dry suits secured the dinghy and used lines to move it away from a potential towback area. A safety boat was launched to assist with extrication. Both casualties were rescued from the water and handed into the care of paramedics on scene. Police were also in attendance and closed the road while the incident was dealt with.
The first full budget approved by Flintshire County Council's new Tŷ Dwy Sant headquarters has been voted through by members. But what does it really mean for residents? The approval of the authority's lowest uplift in 3 years saw council tax increase by an average of 5.77% for 26-27. That gives Flintshire a budget pot of over £421 million, almost half a billion pounds, to fund services. Flintshire's council tax increase is the fifth highest in Wales, despite the Welsh Government's imposing a funding floor that gave the authority a windfall of an extra £5.2 million. Flintshire remains one of the lowest funded councils in the country. Per head, it received just £1,887 from the Welsh Local Government Settlement, placing it 19th of 22 local authorities. In Flintshire, the most expensive place to live is Holywell, where someone living in a Band D property will pay £2,417.57 in council tax. The cheapest place to live is Northup, where council tax is lowest at £2,340.41 for a Band D property. Councillor Paul Johnson, Deputy Leader of Flintshire Council and Cabinet Member for Finance and Social Value, highlighted the stark fact that the majority of council spending is earmarked for social care, social services and education. You can lower a percentage on a page, you cannot lower the need of a child for care or the needs of vulnerable residents, said Councillor Johnson. This budget protects the people who depend on us. For the first time in 3 years, schools were given a small increase in funding. A significant proportion of that extra funding, almost 1.16 million, is for additional learning needs, ALN provision, while significant sums have also been set aside to cover upcoming pay toward awards for teachers. The one amendment by opposition groups that was successful during this year's budget setting related to funding repairs to over 1,500 potholes. Flintshire will pay the most for policing of any local authority in North Wales after North Wales Police increased its charges by 7.01%. As Flintshire has the highest population and highest number of properties in North Wales, it will pay over 3.5 million more into the police fund than the next highest authority, Gwynedd.
A 49-year-old man who threatened a Greggs worker with a large kitchen knife has been jailed for 4.5 years. Leon Andrew Langford of Wirralview, Mostyn, was sentenced at Mold Crown Court on February the 25th after admitting 6 offences committed across 2 days in January. He pleaded guilty to attempted robbery, possession of a bladed article, 3 thefts and 1 attempted theft. The most serious offence took place at Greggs on Station Road, Queens Ferry, on January the 5th. Prosecutor Simon Parry said Langford entered the store at around 7:36 a.m. wearing a blue jacket and glasses, approached a staff member and produced a large kitchen knife, demanding the till be opened. CCTV showed the defendant thrusting the blade within inches of them. The victim retreated to the back of the store and locked themselves away. Langford left empty-handed. Early that morning, Langford had attempted to steal a television from Asda in Queensferry, ramming a trolley into a fire door and activating the alarm. He also stole alcohol from Tesco in Holywell that day. 2 days earlier, on January the 3rd, he had stolen food and alcohol from the same Tesco store. Langford was arrested on January the 15th and answered no comment in interview. The court heard that the defendant has 38 previous convictions for 100 offences, including 55 theft-related offences spanning nearly three decades. His record includes a robbery conviction in 2012 and a bladed article offence in 2013. Sentencing Langford, recorder Benjamin Blakemore described the offence as a significant escalation and raised public safety concerns. Addressing Langford directly, he said, "You're not entitled to simply take what decent, everyday, hard-working people have to pay for. You're not entitled to threaten hard-working people who are simply earning a living. You're approaching 50. It's time to grow up. It's time to start making a meaningful contribution to society instead of being the downright drain on it that you appear to have been from your record for some time." Langford was sentenced to 54 months in custody for attempted robbery, with concurrent sentences imposed for the remaining offences.
The last three dedicated public toilets in Flintshire have been saved from closure. Toilet facilities in Tallaght, Mold and Holywell have been granted a reprieve by Flintshire County Council's Cabinet following a public consultation and the provision of critical funding. News of the proposed closure of the three toilets, the last standalone toilets operated by the authority, sparked a furious backlash last year, leading to a special meeting and a public consultation. There are other toilet facilities available to the public, in libraries and leisure centres, for example, but these three are the last standalone public toilets remaining in the county. Now, Flintshire Cabinet members have endorsed a new toilet strategy and a proposal to allocate part of the UK government's Pride in Place funding for Flintshire to refurbish the toilets. The total refurbishment cost for all three toilets is £240,000, with Tallaght public toilets costing around £140,000, Holywell approximately £70,000 and Mold £30,000. Once restored, town and community councils will be given the opportunity to take over the funding and management of the toilets, while Flintshire County Council explores a new partnership arrangements with private sector businesses to open up the use of their toilet facilities to the public on the High Street. Cabinet Member for Finance and fellow Deputy Leader Councillor Paul Johnson said, "I think for too many of our communities, what undermines local confidence is not always those large policy decisions we make as a council, but the gradual erosion of everyday infrastructure. When facilities close, when town centres look tired, and when public spaces look or feel neglected, that's when confidence drains away. But small capital interventions like this, done well, can reverse that trend. This is about more than buildings, it's about our dignity."
Seven estates in Wrexham and Flintshire remain unclaimed, the Treasury solicitor has revealed. These are cases where there's no will, or the will's beneficiaries or next family members cannot be located. Estates listed can generally be claimed within a 12-year deadline, starting from the date the estate was taken into the possession of the Crown. The list is routinely refreshed and can be accessed on the government's website. Claims can be made up to 30 years after the person's death. However, if the claim is beyond the 12-year period, interest on the money held will not be paid. The estates of these two individuals in Flintshire remain unclaimed. Sean Giles Davies, who died in Queens Ferry, Flintshire, on January the 8th, 2025, and Thomas George Davies, who passed away in Holywell, Flintshire, on April the 10th, 1996. If someone dies without leaving a valid or effective will, their estate can be claimed by a hierarchy of family members. The first to be considered are husbands, wives, or civil partners. Following them are children, grandchildren, and great-grandchildren in order. The deceased person's parents are considered next, followed by full siblings or their children, such as nieces and nephews. If no full siblings exist, half-brothers or half-sisters and their children can claim the estate. The same rules apply to the more distant family relations, including grandparents, uncles, aunts or their children, and then half-uncles and aunts or their children.
North Wales Police have warned drivers in Flintshire North to lock their vehicles after a rise in car thefts and interference over recent nights. Officers said thieves have been trying car door handles and stealing vehicles that are left unlocked. The force said the thefts are opportunistic rather than the signal booster method previously seen in the area, where criminals amplify a keyless fob signal to unlock and start a car remotely. Drivers with keyless entry or keyless start systems are being urged to store their fobs away from the vehicle, ideally in a Faraday pouch that blocks the key signal. In the latest 24-hour period across Flintshire North, police received 58 calls for service, 11 of which were graded as priority, meaning officers attended on blue lights and sirens. Two people were arrested overnight. One was recalled to prison, the other was arrested for sexual offences, which police said occurred in a different force area. Of the 31 incidents logged for write-up, 6 had been recorded as crimes at the time of the update. There were 6 concerned for safety incidents and 2 antisocial behaviour incidents. No hate-related incidents, no burglaries, and no domestic incidents were recorded in the period. Police described the absence of domestic incidents as unusual, noting it was the first time in a long time that none had been reported in a 24-hour window.
Dog owners and their four-legged friends gathered at a Flintshire pub to mark National Walk Your Dog Day. The event, held on Sunday, February the 22nd at the Glasfryn, saw walkers meet at the Mould pub before setting off at around 10 a.m. on a 5-mile circular route through the surrounding Welsh countryside. By the end of the morning, £227.20 had been raised for Almost Home Dog Rescue, with all proceeds going directly towards January's veterinary bill, which stands at between £5,000 and £6,000. Lauren Sutton, co-founder and general manager of Almost Home Dog Rescue, said the pub has been a long-standing supporter of the charity, which was founded in Mould in October 2016. She said, "It was a lovely day. We started off with bacon butties in the morning so everyone could get to know each other, then headed out on a 5-mile circular route. The weather held out nicely for us and there was a bit of a catch-up at the end." Lauren estimated that around 35 dogs took part in the walk, including a mix of former Almost Home rescue dogs and supporters from the wider community. The fundraiser also tied in with the Old Fat Man's Half Million Step Challenge, an initiative led by Dave Sutton from Almost Home Dog Rescue. Throughout February, Dave is aiming to complete more than 560,000 steps, averaging 20,000 steps a day for 28 days. in a bid to cover the charity's soaring vet fees. In a message shared after the event, the pub said, "A huge thank you to everyone who joined our pub walk today. Between the wagging tails and your incredibly generous donations, we've had the best day." What better way to celebrate National Walk Your Dog Day than the sun shining and the feel of spring in the air? Money raised today was £227.20. The rescue confirmed that further pack walks are likely to be organised in the coming weeks, alongside its own regular walks and fundraising events, as it continues working to support vulnerable and abandoned dogs across the region.
A group of Cancer Research UK volunteers from Deeside have raised £16,000 for the charity over the past year, up around £1,000 on their previous year's total. The Cancer Research UK Deeside Committee held its annual cheque presentation at Caffey Naffy in Connors Quay, a community hub for veterans where the group meets monthly. The funds were sent directly to Cancer Research UK, and the committee say all the money raised stays in Wales. Committee member Wendy Mitchell-Craig said, "The group wanted to thank every supporter and all the companies who continue to help raise funds. Ray and I have lost many loved ones to this horrible disease, and we are determined to help find that cure and beat cancer," she said. The committee's main fundraising events included the annual rowing challenge from Connors Quay to Chester, led by Ray Woolley, pub quizzes at the Navy Club, and donations from local families, businesses and funeral directors. Supporters include Yvonne's Cafe, J.E. Davies and Son, Busby and Kane, the Red Hall and the Navy Club. Ray Woolley is a fisherman who's lived in Connors Quay all his life, and he's been raising money for charity for more than 50 years. At 85 years of age, he's well known for his annual charity row along the River Dee from Connors Quay to Chester. Pardon me. The committee has four members: Sarah Craig, Wendy Mitchell-Craig, Anne Evans and Ray Woolley. And they have been using Caffey Naffy for their monthly meetings for about a year.
A Netflix documentary about the investigation into convicted child killer Lucy Letby features never-before-seen footage of the former Countess of Chester Hospital nurse during her arrest and questioning, it has been announced. The film also includes new testimony from police and contributions from the mother of one of the victims. It is the first time a family member involved in the prosecution has spoken in a documentary. The investigation of Lucy Letby was released globally on Netflix on Wednesday, February the 4th. The trailer for the documentary includes footage of Letby in her bed as she's told by police she is being arrested for murder and attempted murder. It also shows her leaving her house under arrest wearing a dressing gown. It also includes footages of her police interviews as she says it was all just spiralling out of control. It also shows the global media attention her trial attracted, the frenzy it sparked on social media, and the doubt that has been cast over her conviction. Letby, 36, from Hereford, is serving 15 whole life orders after she was convicted of murdering seven infants and attempting to murder seven others, with two attempts on one of her victims between June 2015 and June 2016. On Tuesday, it was confirmed that Letby will face no further charges over additional deaths and collapses of babies that were investigated by police. Cheshire Constabulary passed additional evidence to prosecutors last year for consideration, linked to eight potential offences of attempted murder and one offence of murder at the Countess of Chester Hospital. Another two allegations of attempted murder and murder were linked to one child at Liverpool Women's Hospital. Lady Justice Thirlwell's inquiry report into how Letby was able to commit her crimes on a hospital neonatal unit is due to be published this year.
Cheshire and Warrington Combined Authority has been formally established, shifting powers from Westminster following approval of the parliamentary order by Minister for Devolution, Miatta Fanbula. Councillor Louise Gittins, leader of Cheshire West and Chester Council, said, "Today is a landmark moment for Cheshire and Warrington, marking the transfer of powers from Westminster to our region. It's a vital step on our devolution journey, establishing a combined authority before people can elect a mayor in May 2027. The new authority will take control of transport, skills and investment, including a 30-year investment fund worth £650 million. Its board will include leaders and deputy leaders from Cheshire East Council, Cheshire West and Chester Council, and Warrington Borough Council, until a mayor is elected in 2027. Cheshire and Warrington's first mayoral election is set for May 2027, with the authority's inaugural meeting to take place in April 2026. The mayor and combined authority will have influence across key northern, national and international platforms, according to the plan. Councillor Hans Mundry, leader of Warrington Borough Council, said, "In Warrington, we can see the transformative effect of investment and better public transport on a town's outlook and opportunity. By increasing access to good quality jobs and improving skills, we have been able to develop one of the fastest growing local economies in the country. We want to make Cheshire and Warrington the best place for businesses to invest and find new talent and give local people opportunities to find work, improve their skills and thrive." The announcement comes after the appointment of Nick Walkley, former Chief Executive of Homes England, as Interim Chief Executive of the authority. The Minister for Devolution said, "This is a fantastic step for Cheshire and Warrington, marking a milestone in this government's mission to shift power out of Westminster and into the hands of the people who know their communities best. With over £650 million in investment unlocked through devolution, I have every confidence that the region will go from strength to strength."
Cheshire West and Chester Council launches mentorship scheme. Triumph Together is a care-led initiative launched by Cheshire West and Chester Council to help care-experienced young people develop essential life skills, build lasting relationships, and improve their employment prospects through mentorship and community support. The programme connects young people with volunteer mentors from all walks of life who can offer guidance, encouragement, and practical help in areas such as mechanics, cooking, technology, and beauty. Councillor Adam Langan, Cabinet Member for Children, Young People and Families at Cheshire West and Chester Council, said, "Community support can change the course of a young person's life, especially for those who have experienced care. Even a small amount of time, shared skills, or simply being a consistent presence can make a meaningful difference. You might feel you have nothing to offer, but you may have exactly what a young person needs. Whether you have a particular skill, life experience, or have been in care yourself, your contribution could help build a young person's confidence and open new possibilities for their future." One third of the programme's steering group is made up of care leavers, ensuring that it remains grounded in real lived experience. Triumph Together also encourages care-experienced young people to take on leadership roles themselves. People who can share knowledge in any area, volunteers with skills such as mechanics, cooking, beauty, tech, or other practical areas are encouraged to get involved, even if they can only offer a few hours.
A student-led charity event has raised thousands of pounds in support of mental health. Lauren Gilbanks, a final year business management and events management student at Chester Business School, raised £3,690 through a go-karting championship held in Warrington. Organised as part of her final year events project, the Warrington Sprint Cup invited both adult and junior racers to compete at Team Sport Go-Karting in Warrington. Ms. Gilbanks said, "Seeing everyone come together to support such an important cause while competing in something they all genuinely enjoy was incredibly rewarding. This project has shown me how impactful events can be when people unite behind a shared passion and purpose. I would like to thank the staff at Team Sport Go-Karting in Warrington for all their help. The day featured practice sessions, qualifying rounds, heats, semi-finals and finals, with the winners crowned in each category. Fundraising activities alongside the racing include Name the Teddy, Guess the Number of Sweets in the Jar, and a raffle supported by donations from more than 15 businesses. Tim Brown, acting head of Chester Business School and Ms. Gilbanks' project supervisor, said Lauren's project is an outstanding example of learning in action. She has demonstrated professionalism, creativity and determination in delivering an event that achieved a remarkable funding total for the charity Mind. We are incredibly proud of Lauren's achievement and the positive impact her work has had on the community.
A Chester fish and chip shop manager is celebrating after being named the best young fryer in the UK. James Ellams, 23, runs Fish and Chips at Weston Grove in Upton and was up for the award for a second consecutive year at the National Fish and Chip Awards. In the prestigious event held in London and presented by actor Stephen Mangan, James was named the Dry White Young Fish Fryer of the Year and was presented with his trophy. Dry White Young Fish Fryer of the Year award was launched in 1995, before any of the competitors were born, and has been recognising emerging talent and their abilities to finesse the cooking of the nation's beloved takeaway. James said, "I am absolutely thrilled and extremely honoured to be named the Dry White Young Fish Fryer of the Year 2026. The rigorous multi-stage judging process was challenging, but the expert feedback I received along the way has been invaluable, really boosting my confidence and my skills. To be eligible to enter the category, applicants have to be aged 25 and under with at least 6 months' experience frying solo." Kelvin Lee, Managing Director of Dry White Limited, added, "After being a strong contender for the last 2 years, James's persistence has served him well, beating off very strong competition to a well-deserved win this year. The National Federation of Fish Fryers is the organiser of the awards, which has been recognising excellence since 1988. President Andrew Crook has called this year's cycle one of the most impressive in recent years. The next generation of professional fryers coming up the ranks are forces to be reckoned with. James and the other category winners from the awards have been invited on an exclusive study trip to Norway."
A Chester woman who has volunteered with St John's Ambulance for nearly 50 years is celebrating the bestowing of a great honour. Karen Cox from Hanbridge was honoured this week by her appointment to Dame of the Order of St John, which is a royal order of chivalry established in 1888. The Order can award honours to people or organisations who make a selfless contribution to humanity. Entries by invitation only and subject to the sanction of His Majesty the King, Charles III, in recognition of progress towards its mission and values. Karen, who is a consultant for the NHS, joined Chester St John Ambulance in 1979 as a cadet and has volunteered with the organisation for the past 47 years. In 2017, she became a trustee of the charity in Wales and in 2024 was appointed as Chancellor of the Order of St John Priory for Wales and is Vice Chair of the Board of St John Ambulance Cymru. Karen admitted a sense of great pride to receive the award. She said, "I am humbled to be appointed a dame within the Order of St John. It's an organisation that has been ever present and shaped my life in so many rich and rewarding ways, including my day-to-day work as an NHS consultant. I have gained so much from being a part of this truly fantastic organisation. I continue to be inspired by our St John people, both our volunteers and staff, their dedication, talent and unwavering commitment to serving their communities and saving lives is without bounds. They give thousands of unpaid hours each year to help other people. There is nothing more selfless. I'm particularly proud of our young people, Badgers and Cadets, who really do embody all we would hope for in our future generations, and all those adults and families who support them in their development and make their learning fun and engaging. Learning first aid can and does make a difference to so many people's lives. I would strongly urge anyone who has not recently learnt CPR or how to use a defibrillator to book onto a course now."
The team at one of the city's most loved bars have marked their 25th anniversary by carrying out 25 acts of kindness. Bar Lounge celebrated the milestone with a year-long programme of charitable giving that saw the team complete their 25 acts of kindness. Since opening its doors in Chester in 2000, Bar Lounge has remained deeply rooted in the local community. And the anniversary initiative has raised more than £25,000 for good causes and supported organisations across Chester, Flintshire and the wider region. The team took on a wide range of challenges, from abseiling down Anfield to walking hundreds of miles, racing ducks, planting flowers and volunteering countless hours. In May, floor manager Chloe led the 50K in May initiative in support of the MS Society, with the team collectively tracking their daily steps to reach a 50,000 step target and ultimately reaching an impressive 72,000 steps. In August, four team members, Sean, Ollie, Becca and Nick, took on a grueling backyard ultra-style marathon challenge, running 2 kilometres every half hour for 6 hours, to raise essential funds for Chapter, a mental health charity in Ellesmere Porth. The team also reached new heights, quite literally, with Sausages at the Summit, spearheaded by Alex Jones, which saw the group climb Snowdon to cook baby sausages at the peak, raising much-needed funds for SPACE, a grassroots charity supporting parent carers of children with additional needs. A range of well-attended charity lunches, the now annual Sausage Fest fundraiser, and a whole range of individual initiatives have all added to the overall total too. And the team finally smashed their £25,000 target as they concluded their year-long birthday celebrations earlier this month. Founder Neil McDonald said, "The 25 Acts of Kindness project reflects everything Bar Lounge has stood for more than two decades." He added, "Chester has supported us for a quarter of a century, and we will be continuing our efforts to raise even more for local causes and to remain at the heart of the local community for as long as we are able." Well, we hope that you found our selection of news items of interest this week, I'd just like to thank our readers. So Margaret, Esther, Helen, Patrick, Caris and Pam. And also to thank Owen, who will be working behind the scenes to edit the edition and upload it. And I'm now going to invite our readers to join me in saying goodbye to end the live part of this edition. Goodbye.
Goodbye.
Goodbye. Goodbye. Goodbye.
Kevin Roberts will retire from playing next month. Roberts, who has made 235 appearances for Chester and also played 79 times for Wrexham between 2017 and 2019, will hang up his boots following the Blues National League North encounter with Darlington on March the 7th. At the conclusion of his playing career, stalwart Roberts would pick up a full-time physiotherapist role at an unnamed EFL club. Roberts, who sits third in Chester's all-time appearances list since Reformation, has proved to be a true asset both on and off the pitch over the past 6.5 years. He completed his physiotherapy degree at the University of Salford in 2022. Roberts has spent the last 4 seasons working within Chester's medical department, alongside his playing duties. He returned to the Phoenix Club in the summer of 2019, having previously played for Chester City. Blues manager Callum McIntyre told the club's website, "Kevin's calling time on an absolutely fantastic career. To have achieved what he has achieved across the clubs he has played for is a testament to his qualities both on and off the pitch. He's one of a handful of players that have represented both Chester City and Chester FC, made all the more special given his progression through the youth team at Chester City. As a manager, he has been incredible to work with, an outstanding professional who has been an enormous part of our dressing room in recent years. As a young manager taking on the reins of a big club, what you get from your senior players is massive, and I couldn't have asked for any more from Joe. What he's brought to the table for me as a manager. People may not be aware of his dual role, but he is an outstanding physiotherapist in his own right. The improvement in our injury record year on year is testament to his, along with Luke Davis' work. It is no surprise he has had the opportunity to move into a full-time role in the Football League. I thank him massively for his contributions on and off the pitch and wish him every success in his new role." Roberts has notched up more than 600 appearances in his distinguished career, winning the FA Trophy on 2 separate occasions with Cambridge United and FC Halifax Town, as well as winning promotion through the playoffs with both clubs. The goals were flying in as Chester lost 5-2 at Hereford last night. Finn Shrimpton and Connor Wood's penalty were reasons for Blues fans to be cheerful, but strikes from Justin Donova, Cormac Daly, Isaiah Martin and George Munday won the day.
A day in the life of actress Jessica Hines. Jessica Hines, 53, was born in London and raised in Brighton. She joined the National Youth Theatre at 15 and she went on to land roles in TV shows such as Harry Enfield and Chums and The Royal Family. In 1999, she starred in the Channel 4 comedy Spaced, which she wrote with her co-star Simon Pegg. She has since appeared in films including Shaun of the Dead, Paddington 2 and Bridget Jones' The Edge of Reason. She also has a recurring role in the BBC comedy W1A. She lives in Kent with her husband, Adam, a sculptor, and their daughter, Frieda. She says, "On a working day, I'm up at 5:30 a.m, although I always love the idea of being able to sleep in. That said, my home alarm is always set for 6. Why? Well, that's what time it's set for. The first thing I do is walk the dog, a whippet called Willow. We live in Folkestone by the sea and we walk for about an hour. She is very fast. Then it's home to my husband, Adam, and our youngest daughter, Frieda, who's 19. Gabriel, who's 27, and Barbara, 22, have moved out now. If it's a special occasion, I like to cook a lovely big breakfast and have all of us eat together. But on an ordinary day, just me, it's something seed-based. It's the perfect food. Seeds, full of nutrients, gives you energy and fills you up, with yogurt and maybe fruit. In the morning, I like to do my chores. I'm the kind of person who has to get the chores out of the way, and I'll do them until they're done. Then it's admin, emails and reading through scripts, and I'll read a book if I get a minute. I'm currently reading my mum's self-published book called Murder at the Holy Well, a murder mystery set in North Wales. For lunch, I have something green. We have a lovely fishmonger's nearby, so we eat lots of fresh fish too. I'm away a lot for work, so it's great being able to have lunch with Adam, who has a studio in the house. I really enjoyed watching TV shows as a kid, and I watched things intensely. I would deconstruct them in my mind and put them back together. The production values of American shows in particular were amazing. It was like going to the movies. I loved Kung Fu with David Carradine and The Rockford Files with James Garner. I wanted to be Jim Rockford's assistant and help him to break cases each week. When I got into TV myself in my 20s, Simon Pegg and I wanted to write something that was positive, but that also reflected our realities at the time. I'd started out working in restaurants, cafes, bars and shoe shops from the age of about 17 to 24. And so Spaced was about that experience of being out in the world, trying to survive, finding yourself and just being. Am I still in touch with Simon now? Of course I am. I've been very lucky that I've always had work. I loved playing Siobhan Sharp in W1A. She's such a fun character to play. And I've done a detective show for Channel 4 called Patience. I've never done anything like that before, playing a pretty unlikable character. It was challenging and I did at times think, am I doing this right? In comedy, you can feel when you're being funny, but in drama, there's more ambiguity to what you're doing. I went back and rewatched a lot of Columbo to prepare for it. For dinner, anyone who wants to cook, cooks. It was roast lamb last night, delicious. There are many things that I like to do more than cooking, but I do like to eat good food. Television is offering an embarrassment of riches right now. It's like a belle époque compared to what I grew up with, so I like to unwind in front of it. I just wish that I could watch more TV, maybe more Belgian or French TV. I recently watched an incredible Swedish comedy drama called Love and Anarchy. If there's a show we're hooked on, like we are with Pluribus right now, then we'll stay up later than we should to watch another episode. But mostly I like to be in bed around 10 and I like to read a book. There's something very satisfying about reading a book last thing at night, and then I go fast asleep. This was adapted from an article in the Sunday Times magazine of Sunday, February the 8th, 2026.
Artificial intelligence, AI, works out Roman board game. A stone with strange carved lines has been identified as a Roman board game, and artificial intelligence has worked out a way to play it. The thick disc is made of limestone from France, and was found during a dig at some ancient Roman baths in the Netherlands. Small tokens made of stone, glass and bone were found with it. Well, unlike other Roman games we know about, a 3D scanner revealed deep lines in places that the tokens would have been moved, suggesting it was played often. Researchers then handed it to the Maastricht University, where they used an artificial intelligence system called Luddy to reproduce the rules of the game. Karen Jensen, an expert from the Romans Museum, said it may have been fitted into the surface of a table at one time, perhaps at an inn. That's where people came together to play their games.
TNF Soundings. Features from across the UK.
Well, hello again. It's Liz here from East Kilbride. Now, let's think about this for a minute. Have you enjoyed a banana recently? Or perhaps had a walk around a municipal park? Or even marvelled at what they can grow in the greenhouse? Well, that's my man for this chat, Joseph Paxton. It was, in fact, a classic Victorian saga of rags to riches, a poor family, an astonishing talent and hard work, and I suppose you could also say meeting the right people at the right time, which meant by the end of his life, our Joseph had become one of the leaders of society. He was an elected MP and he was a friend of royalty. And it's all to do with growing things in the soil. Joseph Paxton was born in the countryside, which seems especially fitting, and he was born in 1803. He was the seventh son of a farming family in Bedfordshire. He was so keen on growing anything from as long as he could remember that he pretended he was a little bit older and managed to find a post as a garden boy at the age of 15. In fact, he was 13 at the time, and rose very quickly to be the leader of the Horticultural Society's gardens at Chiswick. Now, these gardens were very close to the grand lands owned by William Cavendish, the 6th Duke of Devonshire. Both keen gardeners, they met, they walked, they talked plants, they talked growing things. And William Cavendish, the Duke, offered Paxton at the age of 20 years old the chance to become the head gardener at Chatsworth. According to Paxton's own account, he was so desperate to take up this chance of a lifetime that he rode in the coach arriving at Chatsworth at 4:30 in the morning. He scaled the garden wall, he set the staff to work, he explored the gardens, he ate breakfast with the housekeeper and met his future wife, the niece of the housekeeper, one lovely woman called Sarah Bowne, all before 9 o'clock. She was the woman for Joseph. And as they say, behind every great man, etc., etc. And when he was devoting 15, 16 hours a day, 7 days a week to his gardening pursuits, she managed the family and kept the steady Paxton family going. The 6th Duke had recognised Paxton was an amazing find. Let him redesign the garden, let him skillfully move mature trees. Next on the list, to build and set in a proper setting the Emperor Fountain. Now this was no wee thing you would have in your back garden. It was twice the size of Nelson's Column, and required Paxton to manage and plan and successfully create a lake in the grounds of Chatsworth. His interest in growing plants led him to seek a way of growing exotic plants, such as highly prized pineapples and more, in Britain. The glasshouses at Chatsworth were very dilapidated. He made plans. He set about planning using new ideas in glass design, and he actually made a project built on a ridge and furrow roof, which gave him a stronger planning of the greenhouses, a much stronger structure, which meant, of course, it withstood the storms in Britain, and it meant these exotic plants could be grown. One such plant that had never grown had been brought to Britain in 1836. This was the aptly named Victoria Regia Lily. It had never grown. With Paxton's help and Paxner's design, they built the Victoria Regia House. The water lily grew and grew so large that the extensive leaves floated on the water. Paxton called them a natural feat of engineering. And let's see, he was very keen for a bit of publicity on this great adventure that he'd managed to create. He floated his daughter, Annie, on a leaf of this giant lily plant. Of course, the glasshouse and the heat in the glasshouse meant that it was more than just lilies that could be grown. And that's why there's the banana connection. Because the Cavendish bananas, so-called because of the Duke of Devonshire and grown on the Chatsworth estate to the Cavendish family, were cultivated by Paxton in these greenhouses. And this branch of banana actually accounts for what you're eating, because it's now the one that's the most commonly consumed by banana lovers in the Western world, all by our man Paxton. Now, what else could he do? Well, for his employer, he built the Great Conservatory, which was at that time the largest glass building in the world. And then we come to what was probably internationally seen as Paxton's greatest masterpiece. Because, you see, there was a certain husband of Queen Victoria, Prince Albert. He wanted to please the Queen. He wanted to show the country how modern thinking and innovative the great country of Britain was. Show off to the world. Show off to the British people. We want a design that will mean we could put all these wonderful new inventions of our age sited collectively in London so that people could travel on the new design of the railway and see what wonders the Victorian age was bringing. The Royal Commission was appointed, Prince Albert was leading it, and by 1850 Prince Albert was considerably in angst because they had 245 designs and none of them, apart from two, were remotely suitable. And the two they had would take too long to build. And there were already people saying, you can't build this great big building in Hyde Park. You'll destroy the trees. In stepped our Joseph Paxton. The story goes, by now he was a director of a railway company and making big money at that, and actually bored at the meeting to discuss the railway, and started to sketch his ideas for a design for this great exhibition project of Prince Albert. In fact, you go now to the Victoria and Albert Museum on that site, and you can still see the sketch that Paxton drew while at the railway meeting. This design fitted the bill. Paxton brought in modular, prefabricated design, the wonderful use of glass, such that the building known as the Crystal Palace was built in only 7 months. It was itself a demonstration of British technology. And even more, he managed to change the design of the Crystal Palace and give it a taller middle section so many of the trees in Hyde Park could be accommodated inside the building and there was less destruction to the park. So really, Paxton, by that time, had become an example to every stage of society in Victorian times of a man who, with hard work and talent and supporters in the right places, could build the glorious Crystal Palace. Now, it was later moved at the end of the exhibition, and sadly, it was burnt down in 1936. But we still have lovely images of the original Crystal Palace designed by Joseph Paxton. And we also have the newspaper accounts and the personal stories of visiting the palace, a wonder of the world. Because, you know, as well as people in society and moneyed folk who could visit the Great Exhibition of 1851 in this Crystal Palace, this was the beginning of package tour holidays, and millions of ordinary folk dug deep and took their courage in their hearts and stepped on the new invention of the railways and travelled from all over Britain to visit the wondrous Crystal Palace and the great exhibition of all the countries of the world, seeing new inventions and an occasional elephant from the empire as well. In later life, Paxton developed more gardens, and especially this was the time when he wanted to look after ordinary people. He was the designer of the first ever municipal park in Birkenhead, which was seen by a certain young American designer who called Frederick Olmsted, and he rather liked this plan. And when he returned to New York, he was the designer of Central Park. So our Joseph had influence even over in the United States. I think you must agree with me that by the time he passed away in his early 60s, Joseph Paxton had led an amazing life. And you know, aside from his design for the Crystal Palace and the Great Exhibition of 1851, he really has enriched all our lives. Where would we be without a banana sandwich picnic on a bench in a local park? And with that conclusion of thinking of better days and picnics in a park, I'm going to leave you. All my very best wishes to you all.
TNF Soundings.
Fans' favourite Ollie Rathbone says he wants to create more special moments with Wrexham after extending his contract at the racecourse. Rathbone, last season's Player of the Year, penned a new deal until the end of the 2027-28 season, and fellow midfielder George Dobson has done exactly the same, as the former Sunderland player pledged his future to the club. Rathbone played a key role in Wrexham's promotion last term, scoring 8 goals in 41 League One appearances, and he scooped the Player of the Season award. He missed the start of the current campaign after suffering an ankle injury in pre-season, but has already found the back of the net 6 times. On his new contract, Rathbone told the club, "I'm absolutely delighted to sign a new contract. It's a special day for me and my family. I'm over the moon. My time has been great so far. It's been the best football I've played in my career. I'll keep playing, keep improving and create more special moments for this club." Rathbone has gone on to make 64 appearances for the club, scoring 14 goals in total, and Parkinson says the 29-year-old has been a key player. "Ollie's been phenomenal for us. He's had a lot of key moments," he said. Dobson, who has previously played under Parkinson at Sunderland, signed for Wrexham in July 2024, and he told the club, "I'm delighted to sign a new contract with the club. It's been an amazing 19 months. I've loved every minute of it. It's been a fantastic journey so far. I'm delighted to extend and hopefully we can create many more special memories." Dobson has gone on to make 83 appearances for the club, scoring 3 goals in the process. "Joe's had a lot of years in League One," said Reds boss Parkinson. "Sometimes people may have questions, could he step up, but he has got a sheer determination about him, show everybody that he can play at this level. It's great to see him play."
A day in the life of green cleaning expert Nancy Birtwistle. Nancy Birtwistle, 71, was born in Hull. She worked as a secretary and then in management for the NHS for 36 years before winning the BBC's programme Great British Bake Off in 2014. When a publishing deal didn't follow, she self-funded her first book called Sizzle and Drizzle and took to Instagram where she posted recipes and green household tips every day. She now has more than 1 million followers on Instagram and is about to publish her 8th book. She lives with her second husband, Tim, in Barton-on-Humber in Lincolnshire. Between them, they have 5 children and 10 grandchildren aged 7 to 23. She says, I am nearly self-sufficient in fruit and veg, so in spring, summer and autumn, I'm up at 6:30, sowing seeds, harvesting and preserving. But on winter mornings, when it's cold and teeming with rain, I sit and write. I used to think I was obsessional, but driven is a nicer word. Once I get a bee in my bonnet about something, I cannot leave it alone. It has taken nearly 10 years to perfect my homemade dishwasher detergent, but it's demonstrably better than anything you can buy, I believe. My grandchildren were behind my mission to make cleaning green and affordable a decade ago, and they share that knowledge. Mother Nature has the answer to most things. Have you tried throwing your greasy oven or barbecue racks onto freshly mown grass? Well, leave them overnight there and they'll wipe clean. After about half an hour, him indoors plonks a cup of tea on my desk and disappears. And then an hour later, there's another. About 10:30, he'll say, "Have you done enough?" I always leave my writing in a good place, then we have breakfast together between 11 and 12. Home-crushed apple juice, granola, yoghurt topped with garden berries, I call it freezer jam, and toast, all homemade. I didn't watch British Bake Off until Series 3. I applied for Series 4, but I didn't get on it. I said, "Is it because I'm old or because I'm northern?" And they said, "No, it's because your bread is rubbish." So I tried again and I got on. I'm quite dogged like that. In my 30s, I took a dog to Crufts. In my 40s, I did a master's degree. In my 50s, I learned to speak French. In my 60s, I won Bake Off. And in my 70s, I'm writing book number 8. And yes, I still watch Bake Off, and I can't wait to see what Nigella brings to the tent. She'll be fantastic, and I've told her so. I spend at least 3 hours on Instagram every day. At first, I thought I always had to look my best on there. Then one day I was making a cake and the buttercream split, my hair was awful, my jumper was splattered and I had no makeup on. But I thought, I need to show people how to fix this. That post went crazy. It was humbling reaching 1 million followers. I get 200 messages a day and a lot of before and after pictures of clean toilets after people have used my cleaning product recipes. My Pure Magic spray, which contains citric acid, is a beast. I answer every question. Going green is a lifestyle change, and I see myself as a helpline. Even now, older people say, "You should be enjoying your retirement." And I say, "I am." And if the truth be known, I don't want to be like them. I love my grandchildren, but I don't want to look after them. I want to do what I want to do. We don't eat lunch, but we'll have a cup of tea and a slice of coffee and walnut cake at about 3 p.m. Then I'll take our 2 dogs for a walk. If testing recipes, our evening meal can be a bit hit and miss, but there's always scrambled eggs from my chickens. And I cook for him indoors and he washes up. I'll post again in the evening. I have to admit I'm guilty of double screening. So I've started to read more. I'm enjoying Lucinda Riley's 7 Sisters book series. I'm usually in bed by 10 p.m, but I am a dreadful sleeper. Ideas go round and round in my head. My latest obsession is wild yeast. Sourdough starters take forever. And I'm now making bread from yeast that's used making my own dried plums. It's absolutely crackers, but it works. I always believe that your future is not dependent on your past, and age isn't a barrier to achieving. Nancy Birtwistle's book, Green Living Made Easy, is now available as an audiobook with a running time of 7 hours and 27 minutes and is narrated by Nancy herself. This was adapted from an article in the Sunday Times magazine of 15th of February.
Wild beavers return after 400 years. Beavers are now living wild in Cornwall for the first time in 400 years. 2 pairs were set free at a Cornwall Wildlife Trust nature reserve. Beavers were hunted to extinction in Britain, but they are now seen as a vital species because they create wetlands that help to prevent flooding, improve water quality and boost wildlife. The release is the first fully licensed wild beaver project in Cornwall. Experts say it marks an important step for nature recovery, with more releases across England expected to follow.
TNF Soundings.
features from across the UK.
Hello, it's time to put your thinking cap on. It's Roger with a general knowledge quiz of 10 questions. Question 1. In Greek legend, who turned everything he touched to gold? Question 2. Which infamous person had the first names Orrental James? Think about it. Orrental James. Question 3. What's the national flower of Wales? Question 4. How many yards are in a furlong? Racing fans should know that one. Question 5. Excluding jokers, how many playing cards are there in a standard pack? Question 6. Which of these wedding anniversaries would you celebrate first? Golden, emerald, or ruby? Question 7. Maths. Ready? What is the average of the numbers 1, 2, 4, and 5? Time to think. 1, 2, 4, and 5. Question 8. One of the most obscure questions I've ever asked. What surname is shared by an ex-England footballer, midfielder, played for Liverpool, and a police officer who pursued the fugitive in the TV series and the film? Question 9. By what abbreviation is the International Criminal Police Organization better known? And question 10, finally, one you can have a reasonable stab at. One supermarket chain company in April 2005 became the first supermarket group to have an annual profit of over £2 billion. Big money. Answers later. Roger back with the answers to our 10 question general knowledge quiz. Here we go. Number 1. In Greek legend, who turned everything he touched into gold? Well, that was King Midas. King Midas. A bit of history here, pop music fans. That King Midas in reverse was the first Hollies single that Graham Nash sang the lead on. All about everything he touched turned to dust. I'm King Midas in reverse. Question 2. The famous person, or infamous person, who had the names of Orrental James, as his first two names, was O.J. Simpson. O.J. Simpson. Who'd have thought it? Question 3. The national flower of Wales is, of course, the daffodil. Question 4. There are 220 yards in a furlong. Question 5. Excluding the jokers, there are 52 cards in a standard pack. Question 6. Which of these wedding anniversaries would you celebrate first? Golden, emerald, or ruby? It is ruby. Question 7. What is the average of the numbers 1, 2, 4, and 5? It is 3. You add them together, 1, 2, that's 3, and then 4, that's 7, and 5 makes 12, but you've got 4 numbers you've added. So the answer there is you divide the 12 by 4, and you get 3. this obscure TV come football question, Gerrard, Stephen Gerrard for Liverpool and England, and Lieutenant Gerrard, who chased our poor fugitive. Question 9. By which abbreviation is the International Criminal Police Organization better known? That's Interpol. Interpol. And question 10. Biggest supermarket chain, etc., was Tesco. Tesco. Hope you did well.
TNS Soundings.
Actress Minnie Driver talks about her life. Actress Minnie Driver, 56, grew up in Barbados until the age of 6. Her first major film was Circle of Friends in 1995, and she was nominated for an Oscar for 1997's Good Will Hunting, and also for a Golden Globe for The Riches in 2007. Her television work includes Will and Grace, Emily in Paris, and Netflix's Runaway. She has a 17-year-old son and she lives in London and Malibu. She says, if you have a facelift, everyone says, oh my gosh, she looks too young. If you don't have a facelift, they're like, she's not aging correctly, she looks so old. It is nuts, you can't win. I uphold a woman's right to do whatever she wants and I would never judge. Tony Blair, I think, is one of the most erudite, interesting people I have ever talked to. Blair was a guest on my podcast, Mini Questions. It was really fascinating, regardless of what you think about his policy choices. He spoke about his life as a young student and his mentors. He is interested in people. He was enormously relaxed and sanguine. The Oscars ceremony, when I was nominated for Good Will Hunting, was an exceptional night. It was amazing, having this acknowledgement of the work that I'd done. There were these fragmented moments captured by the cameras. Public heartbreak is a very rarefied, weird thing that not many people can understand, amplified by cameras and public attention. It's pretty brutal, really, but it passes. I wish I could have said to myself, it's all going to be absolutely fine, don't worry about this. I think young actresses feel a lot safer now and a lot more able to speak out and not be worried about reproach. It's really important. The young actresses that I have worked with definitely do not feel the level of insecurity that I felt. It is so wonderful seeing how much more confident they are in advocating for themselves. There have always been slightly punitive measures for women who do that, but I do think that that's changing. Hollywood has implemented things so that there is a level of accountability, and it's definitely improved. I love my body and the way that I look. That is the only way you can get out of this trap of being frightened of losing your looks, through self-love and self-acceptance. I have aged with my face. The TV show Emily in Paris runs on the energy that Lily Collins creates. It was such a pleasure to join that show. It brings a lot of joy to people. We need that. You learn in acting that whoever is number one on the call sheet, they are the leader of the show. And Lily is such a great leader. I am so proud of her. I'm also proud of any young actress who manages to navigate Hollywood while maintaining her humanity. The content of the TV programme Adolescence was enormously sobering. Just realising where our kids are at. All I can do is to double down on my connectivity to my son. I hope that that is some kind of bulwark against what happens on social media and the internet. The great thing about surfing, which I love, is that it levels everybody. When you're out on the water, it doesn't matter if you're a massive DJ or a huge actor, you take your turn like everybody else. It's irrelevant how famous you are. There are some great people there and there are some total idiots. I'm not naming any names. Part of why I love surfing is that it's a brutal form of democracy. I stopped making little independent movies for no money and started making television series for lots of money to secure the future that I wanted for my child and me. I wanted to work, to be a good mother, and to make sure that he was financially stable. I have never had any financial support from anyone.
The last time I took money off anyone was when I was 17, from my dad, for college. I don't watch anything that I've made. I make everything so that other people can watch it, not so I can sit there and pick it apart. This was adapted from an article in the Saturday Times magazine of February the 7th, 2026.
What? Chip shop oil? Organised crime gangs in Scotland are stealing used oil from chip shops and takeaways, police say. Over two-thirds of the biodiesel produced in the UK is made with recycled cooking oil, and restaurants that leave it out for collection can be paid around 30 pence a litre. Last year, 178 separate cooking oil thefts were reported to police between April and October, costing Scottish restaurants around £20,000. Thefts have also been reported in other UK locations, including Derbyshire and Gloucestershire.
TNF Soundings. Features from across the UK.
Hi, I'm Bob Baker.
And I'm Jill Hardiker.
And together we are Sound and Vision,
bringing you the best information, technology and interviews for the visually impaired and those supporting them. Recently, we had the opportunity to find out about having cataract surgery when Bob's wife, Rita, was diagnosed with cataracts at the opticians.
Rita was referred to Mr. Mark Voles, who is a consultant ophthalmologist. I accompanied her to her first appointment for the initial diagnosis and the decision to operate or not.
After that appointment, Bob ambushed Mr. Voles and asked him if he would chat to us.
Mr. Voles was very agreeable after hearing about our podcast for the blind and visually impaired, and I explained that we wanted to inform people about the procedure from the start to finish.
And we'll be hearing later from Rita about the patient's perspective. But first, here's Mr. Voles explaining how he came to be an ophthalmic surgeon.
My interest in ophthalmology was sparked at medical school back in 1990 to 1996. I first experienced ophthalmology in rural India. I was working at a leprosy mission hospital under a reconstructive surgeon who was able to do most operations. In fact, he did everything. He ordered the toilet rolls and the towels for theatre. He was quite inspirational. During that time, an ophthalmologist came along and he must have done about 40, 50 operations in a two-week period. But it wasn't the operating that inspired me. It was the fact that he was able to go out to small villages and teach local paramedical workers how to diagnose eye problems early on. So relatively simple things that would have led to blindness, he was able to teach paramedical workers how to treat things like infection, people who couldn't close their eyes because of the leprosy. He was able to show them minor procedures. So he had this pyramid effect in terms of saving sight. And as a medical student, that had a big effect on me. I thought if I could do something like that in the future, then that would be a good skill to have. So that was the start of my ophthalmology career, really. I was then lucky enough to obtain my first post in ophthalmology in Halifax. And that was when I started learning cataract surgery. I was then lucky enough to obtain a training post in ophthalmology at Manchester Royal Eye Hospital and had some of the best ophthalmologists that I've ever come across teaching me basics of cataract surgery, corneal transplantation and paediatric ophthalmology, all under the leadership of Professor McLeod, who was instrumental in bringing retinal surgery into this country. I completed my training at Manchester Royal Eye Hospital.
After Mr. Voles' experiences and training around the world, he went on to talk about the importance of the relationship with the patient, putting them at ease, explaining what happened during surgery, and the patient's safety is most important.
You're seeing the patients who you're going to operate on, so the start of the relationship comes when the person comes to clinic. And if somebody is nervous about surgery, then you can tell them that we don't actually take the eye out and rest it on the cheek. The eye is in actual fact connected to the brain. And it's good that people are a little bit nervous or anxious, because if they weren't, you'd be slightly worried about them, that they were presenting themselves for surgery It's a very delicate part of the body, being attached to the brain. It's no wonder that people are concerned. We try to sort of allay any fears that they might have about big needles because, you know, once again, as cataract surgery has advanced, there's no need for any big needles. We do most of the operations under topical drops. The surgery is performed via keyhole surgery under the microscope. So the incisions are tiny. 1 millimeter incisions on either side of the eye and a 2.4 to 2.8 millimeter incision at the top. And then we give anesthetic into the eye via those tiny holes. And we remove the cataract via those tiny holes. And with regard to sort of patient safety, it's a bit like sort of taking off in an aircraft. If somebody puts a red flag up at the start of the list, we have the safety brief. And if somebody's not happy about something, then that red flag goes up and that plane doesn't take off and that list doesn't start. And that's anybody from cleaners to the surgeon to the operating department assistant to the nurses on the ward. If somebody feels that the list is unsafe to proceed or it's unsafe to proceed with that particular patient, then it's red flagged and we do not get off the runway until those concerns are addressed, because everybody has a right to speak up for safety.
In this next piece, Mr. Vose talked about cataract symptoms and the methods used to decide if cataract surgery is actually needed. He also talks about the way the surgery is carried out.
The actual listing of cataract surgery, we get quite a few patients that have been referred by their optometrist. And the first thing we ask them is, how much is the cataract troubling you? And if the answer to that question was, well, it's not troubling me at all, then the usual answer is, well, let me have a look. I'll give you my two penneth and we'll take it from there. But if you've got a patient who has a cataract, it's not troublesome, then it's difficult to justify surgery or going ahead with it. So what I normally tell patients is, if you're troubled by misty vision from glare, for example, in bright sunlight or when you're driving, if you're not currently meeting DVLA standards for driving, which are getting tighter, if the optician can't find the right glasses because a cataract can bend the light rays differently from one week to the next, if the patient's currently going back saying the glasses aren't right, then that's another reason for proceeding with cataract surgery. Or if the patient is finding that the cataract is causing such a difference between one eye and the other that they're losing balance or they feel dizzy, then that's another reason for proceeding with cataract surgery. When we examine patients, we look at the back of the eye to see if there's any other retinal disease, such as macular degeneration. I often tell patients that the eye is a bit like a camera. If you have a good camera, it has a good lens and a good film, and you get good pictures. So the lens inside the camera is equivalent to the lens inside the eye, and the film is equivalent to the retina. So if you've got a good lens and a good retina, you'll get good pictures. If the film inside the eye is a bit distorted or it's getting a bit old, then we can do the best cataract operation in the world, but those light rays will be focused onto that film that is aging or doesn't have the necessary retinal architecture to generate clear images. We'll explain this to the patient and give them what's called a slightly guarded prognosis. We try to sort of have a holistic approach really to patients and guiding them through what is or can be a frightening journey, and try to reassure them that we wouldn't do anything for our patients that we wouldn't have done for ourselves. With regard to posturing for cataract surgery, some patients think that they have to lie completely flat. Well, that's not true. I always say to patients, we can try to posture you in a manner that you're comfortable. And sometimes that can take 5 or 10 minutes before an operation. But I always say to patients, don't worry about that time, because believe you me, that will knock 5 to 10 minutes off the length of time that I'm doing your surgery. Because if the patients are comfortable, I'm comfortable, the staff are comfortable, and everything runs smoothly. We have patients that really cannot lie flat because they're in extreme pain, back pain, leg pain. The general anaesthetic eliminates their worries about moving whilst they're on the table.
Lots of reassuring words there from Mr. Vose. Also busting the myth that if you can't lie on your back, you can't have the operation. So next we asked him about the future of cataract surgery.
I'm glad you asked that, because I was at the ESCRS conference, which is the European Society of Cataract and Refractive Surgeons conference in Copenhagen. And there's some incredible research going on throughout Europe, and some of that was presented. And obviously quite a lot of it, because of the title Refractive Cataract Surgeons, they were talking a lot about multifocal lenses and trifocal lenses and bifocal lenses. But the science behind them, the actual transmission of light, is not as good as what we call the standard monofocal lens. But the interesting thing is that the monofocal lens will give you clearer distance vision, if you want that, clearer near vision, if you want that. So it doesn't have the same focusing range. But a lot of the time, we can ask patients if they want distance vision in one eye and a slight offset for the other eye. Or if they're used to being short-sighted or myopic, the brain has a sort of wider capacity to accept distance in one eye and reading in the other. And that's so-called monovision. And the science was strongly supportive of the monofocal as having enhanced transmission modulation factor, which in layman's terms is contrast sensitivity, which is clarity, absolute clarity, compared to the varifocals, the multifocals, which have a wider range of focus. The price to pay for that is the contrast sensitivity that comes right down. We are getting there. The science is getting there, but it's going to be a few years, I think, before the varifocals, multifocals can match the monofocals for clarity.
So what about the patient's perspective? Well, here's Rita describing how she felt about her cataract journey from the beginning when her optician said she might need surgery.
I went to the opticians for my eye test as normal, and they said that my cataracts had gone worse and would I like to have a referral for cataract operations, which shocked me a little bit, I must admit. I just said to the lady, not at this moment, let me go home and think about it, which I did, and I rang up the next day and told them to refer me. I got an appointment through to the hospital, which I could choose which one I went to. I was very nervous, I have to say, but they put me at ease. And Mr. Vaughs agreed that I needed both eyes doing, but my right eye was worse than the left. So he said, "By do the right eye first." And also, he was going to do one eye a short distance and the other eye long distance. And then I waited for the operation day. I was fine until the morning, and I got very nervous. Something new for me, but the staff was brilliant at the hospital. Put me at ease, came, talked to me, told me what they was going to do. Before the operation, the nurses came in and took blood pressure and everything. And then Mr. Vaughs came, and he marked above my eye to make sure that he got the right one, and then said how long it would be before the operation was. But he explained everything very clearly. Walked with the nurse into the anaesthetic room. They gave me eye drops. They explained what was happening. When Mr. Vaughs was ready, he would come and get me. Before the walk down to the operation, they give you eye drops 3 times every 10 minutes. And that is to make your eye bigger and anaesthetic. It was okay. Stung a little bit sometimes, but everything was fine.
So there was no big massive needles. And as Mr. Vaughs says, he didn't pop your eye out and put it on your chin.
No needles at all. They just put the eye drops in. Then you lay down on the operating table. He actually put some more drops in. Then they cover your eye with the cloth. And then you're there for 20 minutes.
So you were conscious all the time when Mr. Vaughs was working on your eye?
Yes, we were actually talking and talking to the nurse that was sat at the side of me looking after me as well. You could see partly out of your other eye. I came back out of theatre. They come and check blood pressure and everything, waited for my medicine, my eye drops, and then I could leave. I had an eye patch on, which I had to keep for 24 hours without taking it off. And then I could take it off, but I had to put it on every night for bed for 2 weeks. And then after the 2 weeks, I could take it off. I had eye drops to put in, which for the first 2 weeks was 4 times a day. And for the second 2 weeks, twice a day. I went back to the hospital. hospital to be checked over for the eye that they had done, and everything was fine. So they then put me down to have my second operation 5-6 weeks later. But I have to say, with knowing what happened the first time, I wasn't nervous. Then you go for eye tests with the optician to make sure everything's okay there. Also going back to the hospital for the checkup. As it stands at the moment, I still need to wear glasses. My long sight is okay. It is my short distance that I really need glasses for. And I'm so glad that I had it done. The difference that it makes is unbelievable.
It's good to hear from the patient's point of view. Rita was made to feel relaxed with their procedures. And it was great that everything went well for her.
We'd like to say thank you to Mr. Mark Vos for chatting to us and explaining all about cataract surgery. Also to Rita for sharing her experience and hopefully helping anyone who's thinking about having this type of surgery in the future.
Thank you for listening to Sound and Vision with Bob and Jill. So until the next time, it's goodbye from the both of us.
TNF Soundings.